Indeed, with our very special guest tonight, Graham Hancock. You know, lots of strange things happening around this universe. We could call it supernatural things. In a moment, we're going to check in with Graham. His latest work is called Supernatural Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. Graham Hancock has become recognized as an unconventional thinker who raises legitimate questions about humanity's history and prehistory and offers an increasingly popular challenge to the entrenched views of Orthodox scholars. He graduated from Durham University with first-class honors in sociology, then went on to pursue a career in quality journalism, writing for many of Britain's leading newspapers. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Graham, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. Nice to be back. How are you? I'm fine.
Doing great out here in the States. All is well, and you know, we just keep the program growing, and it seems to be working that way.
Quite a phenomenon.
Absolutely, Graham. Speaking of phenomena, this book, my gosh, Supernatural. How long have you been working on this one?
Well, it goes back many years, but in terms of a focused effort to actually write a book, about 3 years.
What's your take on, because so many people have their own definitions for the word, like supernatural. How about you?
Well, the supernatural, if we go strictly to the dictionary definition, we have science, we have observation of nature, and certain rules and forces have been established as the laws of nature. So supernatural technically is anything that cannot be explained within the existing laws and forces of nature. But probably a good idea to orient my own view on this from the outset, as it'll help to shed light as we go along. I think when we talk about supernatural beings, whether they be ghosts, whether they be demons, whether they be angels, whether they be fairies and elves, or even the latest manifestation of the supernatural, and I think that's largely what we're dealing with the so-called alien phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I believe that we are dealing with something real. I want to state this at the outset. It's something real. But it isn't something of our physical dimension. It exists in other dimensions and vibrates at a different frequency from the frequency that our senses are tuned to. And I think what is the common factor in all supernatural experiences is that the person or group of people who have those experiences are in what is called an altered state of consciousness. Now, altered states of consciousness can be brought about by a whole range of different techniques. Shamans in hunter-gatherer societies all around the world are the masters of this, and they have developed over tens of thousands of years a range of very specific techniques that are designed to put them into an altered state of consciousness so that they can effectively retune the receiver wavelength of their brain and tune in to these other dimensions and deal and negotiate directly with the supernatural beings who inhabit them. And amongst them, the most common shamanic technique is the cultivation of certain powerful plants, shamanic plants, which we in the West call hallucinogenic plants,
right,
which create visions, or which make visions possible. But there are many other techniques: rhythmic dancing, certain kinds of music played repeatedly over long periods of time, austerities, starvation, even pain. Sometimes the atmosphere of particular places can have this effect. Electromagnetic fields can have this effect. This is why I think certain houses produce experiences of ghosts, because the house itself works on the consciousness of the individual. So there's a whole range of techniques and methods. Some people do this spontaneously. About 2% of every population have their brain chemistry at just the right setting to tune in to these other dimensions. But for those of us who are not in the 2%, we need a push. And either one of these shamanistic techniques, the use of plant hallucinogens, for example, or electromagnetic fields, intense electromagnetic fields, the environment of a particular place can push us temporarily into this altered state, and suddenly we start picking up the transmissions from the other side. It's like we open a secret doorway inside our brains and are able to project our consciousness through into other dimensions. And this, I think, is why the supernatural has proved so difficult to measure and investigate by the techniques of mainstream science, because mainstream science just can't go there. We have the instrument inside our heads. It's called our brains. And the essential factor is to retune its receiver wavelength. And the exciting thing from the study of shamanistic cultures that I've been involved in is that it offers us a reliable and systematic manner to investigate the supernatural realm. In other words, if we can learn from shamans, then it's possible for us to actually directly investigate this realm. And fortunately, some of our scientists, a very few, have begun to do this and have begun to do it in a scientific manner.
Are the shamans, Graham, approachable? I mean, will they talk to people who come upon them?
Absolutely. I've spent a great deal of time in the Amazon jungle working with shamans there, and I find them the most grounded, the most practical, the most reasonable people on Earth, extremely approachable. Many of these shamans, even in remote regions of the Amazon jungle, feel that they have a mission to the West. They feel that the West has become sick, and dangerous creature. And they see the evidence of this in the ongoing destruction of the rainforest all around them. And they feel that they understand the reason for this, that the West has lost contact with the spirit world. We no longer have a direct connection with the world of spirit. We've handed over our personal responsibilities in this area to a class of intermediaries, the priests, the mullahs, the rabbis, who themselves very rarely have any direct contact with supernatural realms, but simply repeat what they have been told by the previous generation. And in fact, many of the established religions are reluctant and unhappy at the idea that an individual might directly contact supernatural realms. But this, the shamans in the Amazon feel, is essential for the recovery of health by the West, that we reestablish our connection with the spirit. And as the shamans rightly say, the spirit, the supernatural world, is all around us all the time. It interpenetrates our lives in every way, whether we like it or not. And where they're different from us is that shamans have made a virtue of this. They've said, okay, the supernatural realm is there. It does affect everything we do. We must deal with it directly. We must investigate it. We must negotiate with it. This is what's so different about us in our society today, that we deny the existence of this realm. We want nothing to do with it. We diminish it. We deride it. We ignore it. We say, oh, we can't measure it. We can't weigh it. We can't count it. So therefore, it doesn't exist. The shamans of traditional societies have preserved and kept alive a tremendous mystery, and now is the time for us to learn to them. And yes, very approachable people.
Are these shamans, are they growing in stature, and I don't mean in height, but are we getting more and more of them, or are they dying off, Graham?
No, I would say in a curious kind of way, we're getting more and more of them, because I need to emphasize that what is the crucial characteristic of a shaman? The crucial characteristic of a shaman is that he or she is an individual who has mastered altered states of consciousness, who can put their consciousness into a different place and explore the realms that open up there. So the essence of shamanism is experience and practice. It isn't centuries of so-called knowledge or received wisdom handed down from generation to generation. It isn't a body of texts. It isn't a body of teachings. It's actual direct experience of the supernatural realm attained in deliberately induced altered states of consciousness. So the shaman is not a victim. The shaman is not like somebody possessed who is possessed by a spirit from the other world. On the contrary, the shaman is an active player entering the other realm and negotiating and dealing directly with the spirit beings there for the benefit of humanity. Now, in their own cultures, these men and women are primarily healers. That is their predominant role. A very few of them go bad, and they use the powers that they gain by entering the supernatural realm for evil purposes. And you can call those sorcerers, just as they were called in ancient times. But the vast majority, if we take the case of the Amazon, are curanderos, are healers. And they work their life is very dedicated to their community and to the healing and to the good health of their community. And they just recognize and absolutely understand that we cannot deal with any single health problem or any single problem of the world today if we do not deal with the realm of the spirit, if we do not take that into account. And every sickness that we see in the world today, including the disastrous state of international relations, if we go down right to the bottom of it, we'll find that there is a spiritual cause. And if we fail to address that spiritual cause, we will never, never, never solve the problem. So in answer to your question, are shamans becoming more common or less common? I would say more and more shamans exist, and many in the West can rightly be regarded as shamans now, who have pursued this experience of altered states of consciousness and of using altered states in a systematic manner to directly project our consciousness into other realms and other dimensions. The number of those individuals is increasing, and increasingly Western shamans are offering ceremony, because the ceremonial context in which the altered state of consciousness takes place is absolutely vital. It's part of the retuning of the brain. And gradually this idea is emerging from the depths of the rainforests and taking its place in the modern world in which we live. And I believe it's just in time for us. It's what we need most of all today.
You know, Graham, you had just mentioned spirits, fairies, aliens, that they may all indeed be the same thing.
Yeah.
How about your evidence on something like that?
Well, I think that first it came to me gradually, and I should preface this remark by speaking of the extraordinary work that was done in 1969 by Jacques Vallée, whose book Passport to Magonia is an absolute classic and a wonderful work of scholarship, and was the very first investigation to seriously compare the so-called alien abduction experience and encounters with aliens with the phenomenon that was called fairies and elves in the Middle Ages. And what I've done is, in Supernatural, in a section of Supernatural, is I've taken that inquiry on with all the new evidence that has become available since 1969, and I've added to it a very specific investigation into the beings that shamans all over the world call spirits. And at one level, it's really extremely simple. If you just listen to what people say and look at what the spirits that shamans deal with do, at what fairies and elves were reported to do to our ancestors in the Middle Ages, and what aliens, so-called aliens, do today, you'll find that they are all doing absolutely the same thing. Very intriguing similarity. Perhaps people who've only superficially studied the alien abduction phenomenon may not be aware of this, but a great deal of very serious scientific work was done on the alien abduction phenomenon, for example, by Professor John Mack of Harvard University.
God rest his soul.
A wonderful man and a friend of mine, and what a tragedy that we lost him in such an unnecessary traffic accident, which actually happened in London. And then David Jacobs at Temple University, Bud Hopkins and others have done very serious work over the years drawing out the reports of UFO abductees, of people who believe they've been abducted by aliens. And it's very intriguing that in a large number of cases, in fact, the majority of cases, the being that later transforms into a typical gray first appears in the form of an animal, or in a part animal, part human form. Now, there's a technical term for part animal, part human creatures, and that is therianthropes, and that comes from the Greek therion, which means wild beast, and anthropos, which means man. And it's astonishing how commonly UFO abductees first meet their aliens in this therianthropic form, as part animal, part human. They're shapeshifters, they're transformers. Now, amazingly, if you go back into the medieval records, you find that exactly the same is true of fairies and elves. I have a 14th century woodcut from Holland sitting on my desk, which shows a group of fairies, and they are dancing in a ring, and these beings are part human and part animal. They have horns and hooves, and at the same time, a human appearance. And that is how fairies were seen at that time. Another was the fearsome medieval fairy, whose name was Melusine, and she was part serpent and part human.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Graham.
Well, she was feared because she used to abduct human babies. And there were repeated cases of fairies and humans being involved in mating, in breeding, exactly as we have in the reports of alien abductions, that there's this appears from the other world to be this sexual interest in the human race. The same is true of the spirits that shamans deal with. Many shamans experience themselves to be abducted by the spirits. They're taken up into the sky. They're forced to have sex with them. Many shamans believe that they have a spirit wife and children in the other world. So strongly do they believe this that it actually causes damage to their relationships in this world. And again, this is very common with alien abductees, and was common with people abducted by fairies in the Middle Ages. So there's just an astonishing range of similarities and connections uniting these three phenomena. And my sense is that we are dealing with the same being. And I can actually trace the first documents referring to these beings, the painted caves of Upper Paleolithic Europe, back 35,000 years. This has been a continuous experience in human culture, but I honestly don't think it is physical nuts and bolts aliens from other planets in this physical universe. I think the problem is much more mysterious and much more interesting than that. I think the evidence suggests we're dealing with transdimensional beings that have an interest in us, and that evolution has equipped us with a means to contact.
What brought you to this point, to this theory?
Well, I really started out having worked for many, many years on the subject of the lost civilization. I suppose my best-known book is Fingerprints of the Gods. And Fingerprints of the Gods gathered
a classic,
together.
By the way, Graham, an absolute classic.
Thank you. The book is very dear to my heart. And it was published in 1995. And I spent many years working around that specific subject, trying to shed light on the possibility that there may have been a huge forgotten episode in human civilization, a lost civilization, in fact. And I worked in depth on this subject through a series of books, of which the last was Underworld, which was published in 2002. And for Underworld, I took this investigation as far as I could possibly take it. I learned to become a scuba diver. And I did deep and dangerous dives more than 2,000 dives, in fact, in locations all around the world, looking for the submerged traces of a lost civilization. And indeed, I found a great deal. But when I had published that book, I felt, actually, I have taken this investigation as far as I personally can take it. There's a danger, if I continue down this track, that I'm just going to end up repeating myself and not saying anything new. And it's time for other people to step into this area of inquiry, and time for me to move on. And I had always had, I'd always had a great interest in the mystery of human origins. Who are we? Where do we come from? Why are we here? And I decided that I would investigate that mystery, that this would be my next project. I'd already been accumulating information on it for years and years and years. But as I really got into the subject, I found, unexpectedly found, that I had to deal with the supernatural that our ancestors were dealing with the supernatural, that the supernatural may have been the key that made them human in the first place. This was the mystery that I found myself up against, and I realized that my inquiry was ultimately going to concern much more the nature of reality than just the issue of human origins.
Stay with us. Graham Hancock, our special guest with his book, Supernatural, Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you've been thinking about becoming a StreamLink member, just don't know what to do, just go to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the StreamLink section there, and then you can figure out what might be the best tool for you. StreamLink from Coast to Coast AM. You talk about, Graham, in your book, and I find this to be a very, very exciting segment, that a light being switched on the human brain all around the world, more or less at the same time. Explain that, because I don't quite figure it out.
Well, it's not so much a question of a light being. It's more a metaphor that I'm using. I'm saying that there's a certain moment in human prehistory when it seems as though a light has been literally switched on, like somebody flipped a switch, switched on in the human brain all over the world. And this was the one of the mysteries that that drew me into this inquiry. Because if you look at what anthropologists call the human career, the whole story of the human race, you have a story that's roughly 6 million years long, back to the last common ancestor with the chimpanzee, when our line diverged from our very close relatives, the chimpanzee. And really, and unfortunately, this is a story of 6 million years of boredom. Our ancestors do absolutely nothing. As time gradually passes, we find from the few remains in the fossil record that they're beginning to look more and more like us. They start off about 3 feet tall as adults, with tiny, tiny brains, even smaller than the brains of a chimpanzee. And gradually, over the millions and millions of years, they get taller, they get more upright, they perfect walking on two legs, their brow ridges begin to recede, the brain size gets bigger and bigger. By 500,000 years ago, our ancestors have brains exactly the same size as ours, and by 200,000 years ago, they are fully anatomically modern in every sense. There's a skeleton from Ethiopia dating to 196,000 years ago, which is in every sense identical to a modern human being. You wouldn't blink if you passed this individual in the street. He looks exactly like you or I. And brain casts tell us that their brain size was identical to ours. The brain was organized in the same way as ours. We're dealing with us. Genetically, they're identical to us. And yet, despite looking like us and being genetically identical to us, these beings of 200,000 years ago don't behave like human beings at all. They behave like shuffling, tool-using apes. They have no religion, no culture, no art, no lateral thinking. They're really bad hunters. It's amazing that they managed to survive for millions of years.
As long as they did, yeah.
Yeah, they have no broader wisdom whatsoever. They just seem to live for the moment and incredibly dull. So although we might not bat an eyelid if we passed them in the street, they would certainly send us to sleep if we listened to them at a dinner conversation. And this goes on for more than another 100,000 years, and it's really, you have to really come down until just 40,000 years ago, or even less, 35,000 years ago, when suddenly, all over the world, you get evidence that a tremendous change has taken place in this being. It's as though something has been done to our ancestors. And suddenly, almost out of the blue, we are creating the most extraordinary, transcendent art that the world has ever seen. And this is the art of the painted caves of southern Europe and of the rock shelters of places like South Africa and Australia. You find the art in North America and in South America, painted, always painted on rocks or in caves. And you know, the famous cave of Lascaux in France, which dates back about 20,000 years. When Pablo Picasso, the great artist, entered that cave in the 1930s, when he came out, he was interviewed by reporters, and he just stood there amazed. And he said, you know, we have invented nothing. That these people of so long ago were creating this just amazing world-class art. And the mystery is that they do it absolutely out of nowhere. One minute they are these shuffling ape men. They look like us, but their behavior is that of ape men. The next minute they are producing works of art that stunned Pablo Picasso. And this is the mystery as to why did this light switch on in our brains. And I think the clue to that mystery, the answer to that mystery, is found in the art itself, because an absolutely universal characteristic of this mysterious rock and cave art all around the world is that it features those beings that I mentioned in the last segment that are technically referred to as therianthropes, part animal, part human beings. They're in a state of transformation between human and animal. So you see a man with the head of a bison and the hooves of a bison. You see the figure of a woman who, the woman is actually depicted headless, but the head of a lion is emerging from her arm. So this is not a question of people being dressed up in skins. This is a question of actual transformation, a shape-shifting, transforming being. And these are the very earliest paintings that we have from anywhere in the world, are these paintings of beings that can only be described as supernatural beings, because we do not encounter beings like that in everyday life. These were not paintings from nature. These artists were depicting something that they had seen and that had a very powerful impact on them. And I believe that's exactly what happened, that they cultivated altered states of consciousness, perhaps the first by accident.
How do we know they weren't just hallucinating, Greg?
Well, you see, this is the crucial question, because we have to try to understand what hallucinations are. The phenomenon called hallucinations, or visions, if you like, is very poorly studied. There was work that was done on this during the 50s and 60s, and then with the tremendous hysteria that accompanied the war on drugs, when just all drugs were lumped together in one category and called bad, the work that psychiatrists had been doing with hallucinogens and human volunteers, which allow us to directly study this this mystery, was stopped. And in fact, that work wasn't started again until the 1990s. And perhaps we'll come on later to a discussion of Rick Strassman's incredible work with dimethyltryptamine and DMT. But the point is this: we actually don't know what hallucinations are. Many scientists just dismiss them as wanderings of the mind and say they're absolutely meaningless, that in an altered state of consciousness, the individual is bizarrely stitching together elements from his or her personal memory and imagination, and these are what hallucinations are. Absolutely no evidence for that theory whatsoever, and a great deal that contradicts it, most notably that in these altered states of consciousness, particularly those that are induced by shamanic plants and other shamanic techniques, people from all different cultures and all different parts of the world and all different periods of time all seem to encounter the same other world, inhabited by the same incredible supernatural beings who have teachings to give us. They may do strange and terrifying things to us, but they always also teach us. And that is true in the latest incarnation of this phenomenon, which is the alien abduction phenomenon. Hallucinations are a kind of perception. We don't even understand everyday perception. We don't understand how we do, of course, understand the lenses of the eye, but we do not understand how this 3 or 4 pounds of jelly inside our skulls that we call our brains transforms light rays into consciousness, into experiences, into emotions. We don't understand how that happens at all. And it's well understood that every perception is affected by the culture and the background of the individual who has those perceptions. I believe the same is true for hallucinations. They are another form of perception. particularly as cultivated by shamans. They are another form of perception, and they also are affected by our cultural background. So what happens is that as these experiences are undergone in different cultures, the culture imposes itself on those experiences. You get slight regional variations as a result of different cultures, but the astonishing thing is that at root, everybody is seeing the same thing. And this is incredibly hard to explain. If the idea is that this imagery is hardwired into our brains in some way by genetics, by evolution, then we have almost a bigger mystery as to how it got there. But for me, the most elegant and the most satisfactory explanation, and one that increasing numbers of scientists who work with altered states of consciousness are coming to consider, is that what happens to us in an altered state is that the receiver wavelength of our brains is retuned, allowing us to gain access to other dimensions, perhaps the very dimensions that quantum physicists speak so much about these days, allow us to get into those dimensions, to contact and to deal with their inhabitants. And this is what shamans do every day of the week.
Now, the mere fact that this seems to be growing, at least that's my perception, the growing in the faith, the growing in the ability, in the need to do some things that are outside of the box. Do you see that yourself, Graham?
There's a desperate need. People all over the world, individuals, good people, are deeply concerned and troubled by what is happening in the world. It seems that our governments are out of control, that the juggernaut of industry and technology is out of control, that we are being marched blindfold towards the abyss of catastrophe by governments and industry that have utterly lost contact with the reason we are here on this planet in the first place, that have utterly lost contact with the mystery of the spirit. And I think people everywhere are reaching to find an answer to this. And unfortunately, the mainstream, the orthodox religions, all too often become part of the problem rather than a solution to the problem. We have to put our hands on our hearts and honestly admit that a huge amount of the dreadful, vicious, and evil conflict that is taking place in the world today has to do with people's religious sentiments and ideas.
Yes. So true.
And these are religions that they have simply received from their parents at childhood and accepted as true. They've never used their consciousness to investigate the propositions of the religion. They are simply told it's true by the previous generation, and they tell the next generation that it's true. And you can trace this back down the generations, one generation telling the next, this is true. And on the basis of that alone, the word of the previous generation, no other facts, no other information, no direct personal experience, people come to deeply prejudiced conclusions about the nature of the world we live in and about others. And this leads to horrific conflicts where people believe that their way is right and no other way can possibly be right. Whereas, aren't we all, in our depths, reaching for the mystery and meaning of life and reaching to recontact the spirit? And it may be that this very old form of religion, the form of religion that actually made us human in the first place, shamanism, direct contact with the spirit realm, that this may be where the saving of the human race lies, if only we can recognize it. And I think that sense, that consciousness, it's the hope for the future, is spreading around the world now, slowly at first, but gathering pace and coming to a point where the vested interests, the powers that be, big government with its gray bureaucracies that seeks to control every aspect of our lives, that seeks even to reach inside our brains and control what we may and may not experience, that this destructive and deadly system is on its last legs, and that the future lies in the hands of individuals who are prepared to go forward bravely and experience their lives for themselves.
Do you think government will try to capture these people eventually once they become known for their own experiments?
Well, I think that we already have a situation in which, puzzlingly and perplexingly, although we believe we live in democracies and free societies, there are powerful, rigid rules in place which prevent us from experimenting with our own consciousness. You know, my consciousness is what makes me human. It's the most precious aspect of humanity. And I find it extraordinary that in the privacy of my own home, doing no harm to others, I am forbidden by law and may be sent to prison for many years for making use of certain natural plants which shamans, for example, in the Amazon have used for tens of thousands of years to contact the spirit world. It seems to me extraordinary that governments seek to control the experiences we have inside our heads, not what we do, but simply the experiences we have. This is a very sinister development. It's a huge intrusion on the liberty of a responsible adult in an advanced society, and yet we're being persuaded to accept this as the normal run of things. And I do find it very, very disturbing. It smacks of George Orwell's 1984. It smacks of the thought police. That certain thoughts are not allowed to be had, that one may not consider certain things. And our society wants to turn us all into robots who are absolutely dedicated and committed to the alert, competitive, problem-solving mentality that is the basis of modern life. And our society seeks to deny all other forms of consciousness, except perhaps stupefied drunkenness, which is authorized by our societies since it poses no threat whatsoever to the status quo.
You know, Graham, I'm with you on this, and it's fascinating to discuss just the possibilities. Are you at a point now, though, where you too believe that whatever's going on is probably multidimensional as opposed to truly physical, the physical that we understand?
Yes, I do believe that what's going on is multidimensional. It may be possible that, and there is some evidence for this, that in the interactions between dimensions, it may be that beings from other dimensions can even break through physically into this dimension. I don't rule that out, and there are elements of this, intriguing elements of this in some alien abduction reports. But I do think, in essence, that we are not dealing with beings who we could eventually find if we had a sophisticated enough spaceship that we could send out at the speed of light into the universe to explore other planets. There may well be beings on other planets. I'm sure that the universe is full of life and that's what the universe is for. But this experience, this contact that is taking place, is taking place at an interdimensional level, and that is why it is so difficult to measure using the empirical weigh them, measure them, and count them techniques of Western science. We need a different technique to investigate this kind of reality, and that's where, with humility, we need to turn to the knowledge and the experience and the wisdom of the shamans of tribal and hunter-gatherer cultures who have kept the light of this mystery alive for tens of thousands of years.
Prior to the book Supernatural, have you changed your views at all, Graham, or did you always think this way?
Well, I say that my views have been in constant evolution. I have had experiences while researching Supernatural because naturally I have experimented with these shamanic plants myself. I couldn't write about altered states of consciousness without experiencing where these plants take us to, particularly ayahuasca in the Amazon, but other shamanic plants as well. And these experiences have completely changed my view of reality. I do not think any longer that we are dealing with a simple, measurable, and tangible reality. Reality is incredibly complex. It's multi-layered. It's multi-dimensional. We are plugged into a certain part of it. Our society forces us to shift our attention from other dimensions and focus exclusively on this dimension, to tune into the transmissions of channel normal, if you like. But there are other transmissions, other realities all around us, and it is part of our birthright to be able to contact those realities, and shamans have shown us the way. And after one has contacted those other realities, and ayahuasca is an extraordinary way to do that, one never feels the same again.
All right, stay with us. We're going to talk more about some supernatural happenings when we come back. Graham's website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com, but it's grahamhancock.com. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.